It's been 4 years since the blowout sank the Deep Horizon a drill ship, killing 11 people on board and unleashing millions of barrels of oil into the Gulf, creating the largest offshore oil spill in U.S. history. Crude and weathered oil hit hundreds of miles of coastline. It crept into 9 national parks, as I understand it. There was immediate toll of oiled birds, dead dolphins, and some other critters. And a tremendous amount of ink was spilled on how this was going to be an ecological apocalypse. And then microbes set to work and seemed to consume a tremendous amount of oil, as did the Gulf's tremendous ability to circulate and Gulf heat, and a lot of the oil seemed to dissipate. Meanwhile, scientists have been working away trying to assess the long-term damage spill, and that can be a tricky deal when it comes to the Gulf because there's an awful lot of stuff that washes down the Mississippi into the Gulf, making it sometimes difficult to tease out what would come from a massive event like an oil spill and just to the background levels of problems. Now, normally, and I've instructed our panelists here that we would avoid acronyms, but I'm going to make one exception today because I don't think it's going to be possible. It'll be a lost cause, and it's called NERDA. And I'm new to this, but I'll explain it. So as I understand it, under the Oil Protection Act, several federal agencies and the Gulf Coast states and BP are required to complete something called the Natural Resource Damage Assessment, or NERDA. And that determines the environmental damage that was caused by the spill and the effects on the community's economy. And once they're done, the team will then come up with ways to restore the damage and compensate for lost environmental resources. This is likely to cost billions of dollars. And this effort's gone on for 4 years, and we heard earlier in the conference that it's likely to go on for another year, but that this should be something we should quiz our panelists about. Separately, yesterday, some of you may have taken note, there was a ruling by a U.S. District Court judge that ruled that BP was grossly negligent in the spill, making it subject to fines as high as $18 billion. These are civil fines. And that's 4 times as much as it would be under the law if it was merely negligent. That lawsuit continues, and that is kind of going to be the challenge for us today. A tremendous amount of information is locked up in litigation, which is the source of frustration for many reporters looking at this. And so we're lucky to have a panel of experts to help us pick our way through this morass and hopefully give us a glimpse of what we know, at least so far, about the long-term ecological toll and help us really sort of sort this out. Now, before I get started with the panelists, I just want to point out there are at least 2 other people here that you need to know. One is Ben Sherman, and Ben, could you stand? Ben is a familiar face at SEJ events, and he is a public affairs officer with the National Ocean Service. That's part of the great NOAA empire, acronym National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Ben has put some handouts on the back that has a list of links to help you navigate their clumsy website of where to find things. And he's available.
It's being redesigned.
Okay, all right. That's good. And he can get you in touch with folks that if you have questions that we can't answer here today. And secondly, we've got Jason Ryan. And Jason, can you stand up, please? Jason is a former ABC producer in Washington, D.C., who has since moved to Houston and is now a BP press officer, and he's available afterwards to any of you who want to know more about BP's plans, agendas, initiatives, et cetera. And I think Jason has some handouts as well. I don't know if they're – are they on the back table, or do you have them? Okay. Now, do we have any state representatives here? Because they're a part of this whole process. Okay, we don't. All right. So – our first speaker is Natalie Perinen. Did I get that right? Good. And Natalie is the Director of Science Policy for the Environmental Defense Fund's Mississippi River Delta Restoration Program. She was previously worked for the state as a senior scientist, including during the spill. She's been dealing with this for years. And so she's going to launch this with telling us more about all this and the damage and maybe answer the question, how clean is clean enough?
All right, thank you, and thank you, everybody. To tell you a little bit about the Mississippi River Delta, there's an inherent variability within this dynamic system. And this system, the BP oil spill, was the largest oil spill disaster in the U.S., but it happened on top of what I would consider the longest-running environmental disaster in the U.S., which is the catastrophic loss of Louisiana's wetlands. And so you had a system that, unlike what Mr. Morrell said a couple of days ago, has not been resilient to the damages that we've done to it over decades. And the BP oil spill was another stressor that we put on it. So we can't continue to expect to put these environmental stressors on this ecosystem and expect it to maintain its resiliency without acting. So one study looked at the likely oil-impacted areas in Bear Terre and Terrebonne basins, which is part of the Louisiana coastline, and noted that these areas were somewhat stable since the 1980s, and were even able to somewhat recover a couple years after being damaged by hurricanes. So there was some resiliency in that system. Now, they have shown that there's a distinct decline in some of these areas since 2010, since the oil spill, in marsh vegetation cover. And so we haven't seen the system actually have that resiliency that he spoke of. So prior to the oil spill, Louisiana has lost 1,900 square miles of land. We can equate that to the average homeowner's lot being lost every 10 minutes. So a whole neighborhood and easily a day. And so we have this ecological stress that's exacerbated by an oil spill. To reiterate kind of what Ken said, Mr. Rao also spoke about billions of dollars worth of data being collected for NERDA. And he mentioned that organizations cherry-pick what data they report on. What I would respond to that is that there is lots and lots of data being collected, but the amount that's released and the amount that's interpreted for release is very scarce. And so it's not cherry-picking what data we report on. It's the scarcity of data and interpreted data that is an issue for the public and for stakeholders to understand what the toll of the ecological damage is. So we know that more data will come out, more interpretation will come out, and we'll have a better understanding of that. But the data that has been published, enough of it causes concern for the environmental community. Not only for the impacts direct impacts that were experienced during 2010, impacts that are continuing today, but long-term impacts that may not be showing yet. So we can look at examples around the world to see how damages to the food web sometimes don't come through the data for some time, or they're not noticeable within the system, and it takes time for these things to mature. So we have some time that we have to allow the system to tell us what's going on. During the oil spill, 1,700 kilometers of shoreline were oiled. 60% of that was in Louisiana, and the majority of that was coastal wetlands. The cleanup, though, was reported to only be attempted in less than 10% of those oiled marshes. The sensitivity of those habitats make them very difficult to clean up. A lot of it was left to the natural processes. Even today, there are a lot of hundreds of miles of oil still in those sensitive habitats. The thought is that the ecological damage from leaving the oil is less than the ecological damage of trying to remove it mechanically. Do we know if this assumption is correct? No, we don't. We don't know what the long-term effect of the residual oil in those marshes and wetlands are on water quality, on the fish and wildlife habitat that use those ecosystems, or on the marsh and the soils themselves. A recent study was just published in July by Turner and his associates, and they concluded that the average hydrocarbon concentration equaled or exceeded the levels at which stressors occur in marsh fish, plants, and insects, and may lead to cascading effects on the interdependent ecosystem structure and function. So 3 years after the oil spill, they found elevated hydrocarbon concentrations in marshes to the to the levels that can be stressors for those animals that use those habitats. Another study documented that we've seen accelerated rate of erosion on the marshes. So we have these complex results that just give us a hint that something is happening out there, that these results are going to continue to come out and demonstrate that BP needs to act on doing restoration as quickly as possible to build back the resiliency in the system and allow these systems to recover.
Great. Thank you. Thanks so much, Natalie. Our second speaker is Lori Schwaeke, a wildlife epidemiologist and at a research station, research statistician with NOAA's Hollings Research Laboratory in Charleston, South Carolina. She's been the agency's lead investigator for dolphins in the aftermath of the spill, and she has a short presentation with PowerPoint slides for us to see.
Okay, sorry, waiting for my government computer to boot up here. Hold on. So first, I want to thank Ken for moderating today, and I'm very happy to be here and excited to be part of this panel and this discussion. So as Ken mentioned, I'm going to talk about the studies that I've been involved in with bottlenose dolphins, specifically bottlenose dolphins in the nearshore bay sounds and estuaries of the Gulf. But before I do that, I want to say a couple comments just about the overall NERDA. The DWH NERDA has been extensive. It's covered species and resources from the open ocean and deep water. That includes habitats such as the benthic habitats as well as corals. It covers species such as the commercially and recreationally important fish species as well as turtles and whales and oceanic dolphins. It's covered the nearshore habitats as well, oyster reefs and shallow water corals, as well as the mudflats and marshes and the various animals that use those habitats, such as birds and crabs and fish. One of the most challenging aspects of this assessment, and really any assessment, though, is dealing with the large marine vertebrates. These species are very logistically difficult to sample, and species such as dolphins and whales are even more challenging because of their protected status. So when you're talking about small invertebrates or small fish or even larval stage fish, you can do experimental studies to understand their toxic effects. But when you're talking about a dolphin that can weigh up to 500 pounds and take 10, 12, even 15 years to mature and live over 50 years, those types of experimental studies just really aren't possible. So similar to what we do in people, we often rely on epidemiological studies looking at exposed versus unexposed populations to try to get a handle on the effects that are happening. As I mentioned, my team has been focused on nearshore dolphins and bay sounds and estuaries. So one of the back in May of 2010, the DWH oil trajectories were predicting heavy oiling in Barataria Bay. So one of the first sites where we began our studies were in Barataria Bay, Louisiana. And before we went down there, before the spill, there had been a network, a stranding network from Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries that dealt with dolphin strandings in that area. There had been a grad student project that had looked at dolphins and parts of the bay, but there had not really been intensive research on dolphins in the bay. So we went down and immediately started doing photographic studies to document individuals. Dolphins have unique nicks and notches that they acquire over a lifetime on their dorsal fins, I get the pointer to work here, that allow us, there's a permanent markings that allow us to identify individuals and then follow them over time. So since the spill, we've acquired a catalog of over 1,700 unique individuals in Barataria Bay. So as you all probably know, Barataria Bay did receive heavy oiling, and that oiling lasted for a very long time. In fact, the cleanup in Barataria Bay, and parts of Barataria Bay at least, were ongoing into 2014. Because of that heavy oiling and the fact that there are immediate impacts to species such as birds and turtles, it became kind of a ground zero for much of the media coverage. Dolphins have smooth skin rather than feathers or fur, and they're large animals, so they can move through the oil to some degree. So they weren't physically encumbered or mired in oil as many of the turtles and birds were. But still, there was great concern about the toxic effects that, that might occur due to their exposure to the oil. So it was out of that concern that, that prompted us to start studies as part of the Natural Resource Damage Assessment Cooperative Studies to look at the potential sublethal effects in dolphins. And in August of 2011, we began these assessments, and we temporarily caught 32 animals in Barataria Bay, conducted veterinary exams, including ultrasound, as well as taking blood work. We attached satellite link tags to their fins so they could be followed over time to understand more about their movements. There was a parallel study that same year conducted in Sarasota Bay, which Sarasota Bay, Florida, was an area that was not oiled. There was also an ongoing study in Sarasota that had been going on for decades that facilitated that work. And the first findings from those studies, from the 2011 studies, were published this year in Environmental Science and Technology. In brief, we found significant health issues in the Barataria Bay dolphins. This included moderate and severe lung disease, low adrenal hormones, specifically related to stress response as measured by blood cortisol levels. There were other abnormalities in their blood work, and many of the dolphins were underweight. Some of these effects, specifically the adrenal issues, have been seen in other experimental studies of other species exposed to oil. Endocrine effects and specifically adrenal effects have been reported for mink from experimental studies. And then just recently there was a study released on birds that were fed Gulf of Mexico crude oil, and a similar reduction in cortisol response was seen. We're also seeing some signs of reproductive issues in the Barataria Bay dolphins. The animals that we caught in 2011, there was one female that was pregnant. Her fetus was 5 months, but the fetus wasn't viable. That dolphin had other health issues, lung disease, and other health issues, and that could have led to her inability to sustain the pregnancy. Also, what you see in the picture here is Y01. I don't know if you can see her, the freeze brand that we marked her with when we caught her so she could be followed more easily. She was pregnant when we caught her, and she was later seen pushing a dead neonate, so this was another failure. Dolphins, when they give birth, they'll push the newborns to the surface so they can breathe. And sometimes if the newborn doesn't survive, they'll continue to nudge it there at the surface. Sometimes this can go on for days. You can kind of see that the fetus there is somewhat decomposed. So those studies are continuing with the other pregnant dolphins from 2011. We're still analyzing those data, and we also conducted additional health assessments in Barataria Bay in 2013 and 2014. The results are still being analyzed. The samples are still being analyzed by the labs, but preliminary results at least showed some improvement in Barataria Bay dolphins in 2013 and 2014. There are fewer underweight dolphins at least. We also expanded the studies into Mississippi Sound in 2013, and of course we've continued the studies in 2011 and 13. Again, you know, these are large studies, a lot of samples are taken, so it takes time to get results back, but we're hoping to have results available in the next few months to a year. I should mention, too, along with those investigations, continuing assessments, there's been an investigation into an increase in dolphin strandings, not only in Barataria Bay, but in other parts of the Northern Gulf. Those increase in strandings has prompted the declaration of an unusual mortality event by NOAA Fisheries. That event is ongoing into 2014. It also was officially declared to have started in February 2010, which was 2 months prior to the oil spill. But the intensity of strandings have fluctuated over time and in different areas of the Gulf as well. The greatest increases in strandings have been seen in areas that overlap with the inland areas that were most exposed to DWH oil, and that's specifically Barataria, the areas in and around Barataria Bay. That investigation, as I mentioned, is ongoing. It's a unique, as compared to other UMEs, sorry for the acronym, unusual mortality events that have happened in the Gulf, just in the magnitude of the strandings as well as the duration of the event. And further the common causes of previous UMEs in the Gulf, which have been algal toxins such as red tide and morbillivirus, which is a virus related to distemper in dogs and measles in people. Those are common causes of previous UMEs, and those do not appear to be primary causes of this event. So that investigation continues. And I have up there a link if you want more information. I have not been directly involved in the UME investigation other than coordinating our research, but there's certainly more information available on the web, and I can also give you contact information about that. I also have a website there for more information about the broader NERDA.
Great, thanks. Our last speaker is Lucinda Jacobs. Lucinda is a longtime environmental scientist based in Washington State, and she specializes in aquatic and sediment geochemistry, and she is a consultant to BP advising the oil giant on its as its science advisor on the National Natural Resource Defense Assessment, the NERDA. Yeah.
Thank you, Ken. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to provide my perspective. What I'm going to do is step back a little bit, but to start, what I'd like to do is just start with a little bit on my background, get into the role of science overall, talk a little bit about the state of the Gulf and some of the information that's out here, and then talk about some important considerations that I think we need to keep in mind when we're looking at information from the Gulf. I've been doing environmental consulting work for about 30 years. I've looked at contaminants in a variety of environments. Of probably most interest to this group is I worked on the Exxon Valdez oil spill for the trustees 15 years after the spill to address issues related to lingering oil and resource recovery as an independent reviewer and synthesizer of the data that was available. And I'm currently a consultant to BP. What I want to talk about first is the framework for evaluating environmental issues from a scientific perspective. Science brings rigor and objectivity to our evaluation of data. And what I'm showing you here is some of the important steps in going from exposure to adverse effects. And at each one of those steps, there's important considerations. First of all, we look at the oil release into the habitat. And one of the things we learned from EVOS, Exxon Valdez oil spill, is that understanding pathways and exposed organisms is critical to understanding the potential for impacts. So after that release, we identify where we might see organism contact, and the next step would be to look at individual impacts based on that contact. Exposure doesn't necessarily mean adverse effects, so that very first step is really important. We would then go from individual impacts to population-level impacts, and that doesn't always follow from individual impacts, and then the next step would be look at what might be happening at the community and ecosystem level. So just getting back a second to the organism level or the individual level effect, that's where we look at what might be toxic to particular individuals in the environment. And, you know, certainly we know we see dead animals. Those are acute effects. There's also sublethal effects that are of concern. When we can get that information from the environment in this sort of exposure framework, we consider that to be very strong information that we can carry forward into the next step. But we can't always get that information. So laboratory studies, and there have been a lot of publications about laboratory studies recently, laboratory studies are a really good way to get information on dose response and cause effect in the environment. So under laboratory studies, where we're dealing with controlled conditions, we can look at increasing concentrations of a contaminant, and we can look at exposure to a particular life stage or a particular species, and we can look at various endpoints that you might measure in that controlled environment. It's important to recognize, though, that when you're translating laboratory tests to the environment, there's many considerations that have to go into play. For example, the first thing we might look at is the concentration that's tied to effect. And the first question we better ask ourselves is, where do we see concentrations at that level? Over what time period? Over what level? So there's really important considerations that go into translating the laboratory studies to the environment. And if we do see organism level or individual level impacts in the environment, then the next step is taking an assessment and asking ourselves if that level of impact ties into population level impacts. And to take that step, there's a lot of compensatory mechanisms that need to be taken into consideration. I'm going to talk about those in a little bit. So I think you can think about this overall process as links in a chain, and one follows from the other, and there's a methodical and objective way that we go from one point to the next. So what I'd like to show you next is a little bit about what we know about the Gulf from the published studies. And I have to thank Natalie for introducing the marsh story, because that's what I want to start with. As Natalie mentioned, marshes are considered sensitive habitat, and we don't go in and aggressively remove any contaminant, really, including oil from marshes. So we handle marshes really carefully. They're sensitive habitat. So only about 10%, and this particular graph I'm showing you here is from Jackie Michelle, and she was part of the SCAT teams, and that's another acronym. Those are the NOAA teams that evaluated the oiling of the shoreline, and with phenomenal effort and energy and dedication, determined what oiling was occurring over what stretches of beach. And this shows oiling from going from trace to heavy. And the time period shown here is going from May 2010 to November 2012. So what I think this really nicely illustrates, the y-axis is miles of shoreline. And I think what this really nicely illustrates is a beautiful recovery curve. And it's a natural recovery curve. So I think that the marshes are kind of an experimental environment to demonstrate how natural recovery is affecting conditions in the Gulf. And particularly since we were unable to really go in, we meaning the people who were doing the cleanup, were unable to go in and actively remove most of the oil. The other story of resilience and recovery I want to mention is birds. And this is just a tiny snapshot of the information that's out there for birds. But nearly 500,000 observations of birds were taken during this time period, May 2010 to August 2011. Nearly 500,000, and only a very small fraction of those observations were linked to oiling. And I've kind of blown up that little skinny green slice there into the circle on the right to show you the varying degrees of oiling that were observed in the birds that did have oiling. And that, again, is less than 1%. And the resilience and recovery of the birds, it was tragic to see the bird pictures. We all feel terrible when we see what the initial impacts of oil are. But I think that the phenomenal efforts to intercept the oil and limit the amount of oil that hit the shoreline played a big role in limiting impacts to birds. Their methods were used to deter birds from entering oiled areas. There were bird rehabilitation centers. A lot of things were done to protect the birds from the oil that did reach the shoreline. And then the question is, you know, why is this? This is an unprecedented spill over a long period of time in the U.S., the biggest one ever. Two categories of topics I want to touch on here. This first one is all the, and I'm sure you've seen this before. The government has raised many of these issues. These have been in publications. The nature of the oil is light crude, so that means a fairly large fraction of it is more readily degradable than some of the heavier crudes, more readily volatilized. There's a massive response effort, of course. This spill was located offshore, 40 miles, so there was a lot of time to address intercept and remove and do whatever could be done to eliminate or remove the oil. And it also happened 5,000 feet below the surface. And that physical mixing that occurred as that oil was rising through the water column helped support dispersion and dilution, which facilitated or limited exposure. We all know that the Gulf is unique and that it has natural seeps, and there's bacteria that have been acclimated to those natural seeps. And that, of course, was mentioned earlier and did help the situation. And then chemical processes, evaporation and photolysis. We also have a temperate climate where conditions are warm, and so shoreline surface water processes are going to happen faster, like degradation. What I want to spend a little more time, though, is about the biological resilience or some of the compensatory mechanisms that I mentioned earlier, because you don't hear a lot about this. And I think they're really important to at least touch on because, you know, many of these are what protect populations in the environment. The first one, ties to the dead zone or the low oxygen environment that exists off the Mississippi Delta. My first example here. We know that shrimp and fish can avoid that low oxygen environment. And I think that area, speaking of other stressors, reached the size of Connecticut this year. And this is a seasonal impact in the Gulf, and it's been observed since the 1970s. We know that vertebrates like birds and fish metabolize pH and eliminate pH, so that helps. We have the bacteria that have acclimated. We have the life history characteristics. And the life history characteristics are really interesting because when you think about a particular species like plankton, for example, it has a rapid population turnover, so it can bounce back pretty quickly. When we're talking about tuna and mai-mai and a lot of the fish, often you have multiple year classes spawning at the same time. So the impact to a single year class will be diluted out by some of these other year classes. We have high fecundity with a lot of the fish. Thousands, tens of thousands, and millions of eggs can be laid by a single individual. And then we have dietary plasticity. So all of these other considerations need to be factored in when you're thinking about what's contributing to the resilience of the Gulf and to natural recovery. The other thing I want to mention is the density dependence of resilience. I think the best example here is our fisheries. We manage our fisheries to maximum sustainable yield, and that is based on the assumption that we can remove a portion of the population and still have a sustainable population for future years of fishing. And we know that, as mentioned by Natalie, there's a lot of stressors in the Gulf. We have hurricanes, we have storm surges, we have low oxygen environment, we have high nutrient loading. So there's a lot of things to think about in considering impacts to the Gulf. And the species have been shown to be resilient under these multiple impacts and insults. So these are the messages I want to leave you with in providing this overall scientific perspective. Lab studies don't always translate to the environment. We need to carefully consider the applicability of those studies. Exposure doesn't always translate to adverse effects. Individual effects don't always translate to population effects. Other stressors are important. Model assumptions are extremely important. Oh, I should mention on the other stressors, I think the UME with the dolphins is a really good example of another stressor because we know that the UME preceded the spill. So that poses a real challenge in interpreting data related to bottlenose dolphins. And finally, a background and a baseline in natural recovery. You want me to stop. I think in closing, there's a lot of good news, so I just want to emphasize that. And I think there is an untold story of resilience and recovery. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Lucinda. Well, why don't we get right back into the dolphin thing, since you just you raised that. And just so you know, that there is an original paper and on the back table of this dolphin study, a commentary by Lucinda, and then a rebuttal by Lori as well back there. But so
there's also on the NOAA sheet, the press conference, and follow-up.
Okay, all that stuff. But so this mass die-off did start before the Gulf. Have you considered other possible reasons for these dolphins dying? And also, can you talk about this study a little bit, and what's the long-term prospects for these dolphins that are skinny, lung diseased, and facing all these other issues?
Well, one point I want to make in response to Lucinda's comment, that the UME itself is not a stressor. It's a die-off, and there's certainly stressors and or multiple stressors that are causing that die-off, but it itself is not a stressor. And she brings up that it preceded the spill, but the assumption that the cause of all the dead animals is the same, just because it's all considered part of one event, because it's been going on for a while, but it's changed in different areas. It's the intensity has fluctuated, the areas where the strandings are occurring has fluctuated, and so I think, you know, there's not necessarily a single cause that is causing the die-off of the dolphins. But back to the study, and you ask about the conditions that we're seeing and what that would mean for the population. Some of the conditions, specifically the lung disease, is of great concern. I mean, some of these animals, the lung disease had progressed to be masses and consolidation, which even if the animals were under medical treatment, that would be a difficult thing to overcome. The others that had just moderate lung disease, that could be long-lasting. It could open them up to susceptibility to other infections, and so that, again, could be long-lasting. There was a recent study that came out from the cleanup workers for the Prestige oil spill that found that their respiratory systems and symptoms that they were reporting lasted up to 5 years after the spill, and that's for cleanup workers that probably had limited exposure as compared to dolphins that are in the water, breathing right at the water surface and there for a long time. So that's of concern. The adrenal effects also are of concern. Not much is known about we call it hypoadrenocorticism, but basically a lack of sufficient adrenal response. Hypoadrenocorticism in animals and including people, if left untreated, can lead to adrenal crises, which can be life-threatening. It's particularly pronounced in times of stress, and that could be illness, that could be pregnancy as a stressor. And in fact, hypoadrenocorticism in pregnancy could lead to increased mortalities for the mother or the fetus. So again, we're talking about some conditions that are likely going to affect the survival and impact the survival of these animals, may impact the reproduction of these animals as well. So that certainly could have population level effects and long-term effects.
Okay. Well, let's just jump around. So Natalie, you've been frustrated, as I understand, sort of the slow pace of coming to some sort of conclusion and starting some restoration. What plans for restoring the marshes are in place now, and is there a cost to waiting another year or more for this process to wrap up and get restoration underway?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a cost. I mean, the longer we wait, the more costly it's going to be, and the longer it's going to take, the harder it's going to be. So as I was saying, that there has been studies that showed that the oil spill or areas of the marsh that were oil have accelerated land loss. And within that, if we start to restore those areas now, we can maybe start to build the resiliency back into that system and allow those marshes to recover. If we wait and delay restoration to go through lawsuits and fight and battle in court, we will see far more loss of wetlands. And then when you go to replace those wetlands, maybe now instead of dealing with a small bird island that's still somewhat right at the water surface, or maybe it still has some elevation, but all the plants are dead, instead of trying to build on that platform, you're trying to build a bird island that's in 3 feet of open water now. So allowing these things to continue to degrade is going to make our jobs harder down the road.
I want to open this up to questions from the audience. Our rules are the same as always, which is journalists first, SCJ members. If we exhaust all the journalists, then we can go to others. No speeches, please. And I think we only have one microphone. I'll just walk around with it. So you can wait for the microphone. So we can be recorded.
Bob Marshall, the lens here. This is for you. Show the chart of marshes, right?
Yes.
And you show this rapid removal or less oil. I was wondering, is that based on visible signs of marsh, where samples taken, where there soil samples taken?
Yeah, these are from the NOAA shoreline assessment surveys. Okay, so this is the SCAT team that goes out and monitors the degree of oiling. And so this is actually a Jackie Michelle paper from last year. And so these are just SCAT techniques that are used based on, I can't go into the details on them right now, but they have specific criteria depending on the oil spill to look at lightly oiled, moderately oiled, and heavily oiled, moderately oiled.
Well, are they determining this by looking at it, or are they looking at the soil as well? That's what I'm trying to find out. How do they determine if it's oil?
Well, it's visual. Yeah. Well, I know. I think they do analyses as well.
So they do core samples.
Yeah. I would defer to this paper for the details of the NOAA methodologies. They've been used since the Exxon Valdez oil spill. But I personally have never done one.
Questions?
Mark.
So, Natalie, I know that you worked for the state before you moved to your present position. Can you talk a little bit about what the state's concerns were with the response? And I think you've talked a little bit about it, but the response and the concern that there may not have been an adequate review, even with SCAT teams you see, of actually seeing where all of the oil was.
Yeah, I know that there's still concern within the state for the secondary response that's now been called for in the state, where there's not a regular group of folks going out looking for the oil. And so we know that oil is left out there. We know that there could be implications that oil could remobilize. There's the potential for oil to be down on the water, below the water surface, that could come up. So there's still a large threat of oil on our landscape. And so there is a concern, I think, from the state, but for environmental groups as well, of what is the fate of that oil, and what's it going to do to not only the wetlands, but the animals that rely on the wetlands. And if nobody's out there continuing to monitor when it remobilizes, how are we going to address it? And one of the key concerns, I think, to that is the complexity of this landscape, that it's not an Alabama shoreline or a Florida shoreline where people go out there all the time and can say, hey, I saw oil that was remobilized, or oil in a new place. You're talking about a landscape where people don't get out there very often. You may have some fishermen who will see something and report it, but for the most part, this stuff could happen without anybody really knowing about it.
Questions?
I'm Tim McDonald from Mother Jones Magazine, and there are some people who are on the oyster tour yesterday with us, and we had a really interesting conversation with oyster fishermen out there. By Empire, who was talking about the impact that they've seen to their oyster beds and how sort of this release of fresh water that was used by the state as a tactic just after the spill to push the oil away from the shore killed a bunch of oysters. What was really interesting to me was that he was saying that, you know, they've had these freshwater incursions periodically throughout the past. I mean, he's been doing this, his family's been oyster farming for generations, and they've seen this before. But typically, the oysters come back within a year or so, but that now 4 years down the line, they haven't seen any of that type of recovery. And I'm interested in, I mean, and he didn't, you know, think possibly this is related to the spill, or, you know, it's kind of hard to say. I guess I'm interested if you have any insights about oysters specifically, but also the process of, you know, who's doing the work, I guess, to find out whether there is a link between the spill and an impact. This guy gets answers, or is any work being done on
that? So I'll start, and I don't, I'm a wetland scientist, so I don't know an extensive amount about the oysters and what's happening. I will say that there's a lot of, to kind of give you the background of the studying that's going on. So you not only have the immense amount of data collection that's going on through NERDA, but you also have organizations like the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative and academics doing an immense amount of data collection as well. And so I know that there are folks that are looking at this oyster issue to try and determine what the cause and effect of the impacts are. I just don't know if we have anything conclusive yet.
I think I can address that. There's actually a really good publication about the impact. I think there's actually a couple of publications about the impacts of freshwater on oysters. And the issue that these folks are evaluating and determining is it was the prolonged nature of the low salinity or freshwater condition that killed the oysters. Oysters are really well known to be sensitive to low salinity environments. So the duration of the exposure was, I think, the large issue. And so there's a couple of publications that I can refer to refer you to, if that helps.
this is cutting out. I'll sprint.
Hi, I am Rocky Kistner with On Earth Magazine. One of the issues that has raised a lot of concern around here is the use of chemical dispersants, which were used in unprecedented amounts. Local people here are very concerned about to this day. I'm just wondering how the use of these dispersants has impacted your work, and specifically with dolphins and in the wetlands area, because many fishermen I've talked to say, you know, the oil's just sunk to the bottom. And it's still there, but there have been studies showing that that oil and chemical dispersants used together, you know, can make it more toxic. So I'm just wondering how that has impacted your work.
Okay, long-term impact of dispersants.
So there was a recent study that's been published that looked at Corexit and the effect on nitrogen cycling in the marshes, and found that there was an 80% decrease in denitrification and over a 50% decrease in mineralization of nitrogen. Now, the denitrification of nitrogen is important because that affects our water quality, that if there's less denitrification going on, then we have more water quality problems and more algal blooms. The nitrogen mineralization is important because it affects primary productivity. And so if we have a reduced amount of mineralization, we have our plant growth is being reduced, our carbon storage is being reduced, our habitat values are being reduced. So this is just the first, like, glimpse. You know, again, the data just is kind of trickling out that it may have, and the authors of that study did indicate that they are concerned about long-term impacts to the nitrogen cycling and things happening in the marsh.
I'll just say there's not much known about the effects of dispersants on marine mammals or dolphins. It is something we think about. As Natalie's mentioned, there are some studies going on. There's some continuing to look at the, you know, potential increase in toxicity or changes in toxicity related to the mixing of the dispersants. But there's not much known on dolphins, and unfortunately it's not something we're going to do experimental studies to see.
Yeah, I want to mention a few things that might help with the Corexit story or the surfactant story. First of all, at the time of the spill, there were thousands of water samples collected, and scientists looked very carefully for the constituents of Corexit, like DOS, which is one of the ones that's toxic. And basically, they developed a benchmark to determine if they were going to have to continue sampling granted this was just during the response, but not one of those water samples exceeded the EPA benchmark that was used. So that kind of helps to put the Corexit or the application of that into perspective. And I think there are anecdotal stories that you hear all the time, but I think I would just direct you to some of the data that are out there. And I also wanted to mention, too, in terms of data, this may not be the easiest data to access, but I know both NOAA and BP have websites with massive amounts of data to go through. And that's the source that I've been using to come to some of my conclusions on the data. So just keep in mind, if you really want to dig in, it's out there. It's not all out there yet. It's not all evaluated yet, but there's a lot of data.
Well, that raises a good question, because it's very hard for journalists under deadline to dig through metadata. Can any of you offer any insights when there'll be, when the process will wrap up and we'll get some serious meta-analysis of what's going on and some understanding from experts who can dig into metadata, unlike us, who have to file like 20 times a day, like Mark?
I know I mentioned the ongoing investigations on the dolphins, and we're hoping to have information reports out in the next year. And the data, the raw data, for example, on the 2011 studies that we've done, the raw data have been uploaded and are publicly available. And, you know, we're hoping to get synthesized reports out very soon. It's just, you have to keep in mind, they're very complicated systems. It's a very complicated process. And so it takes a long time to go through it all and make sure we're analyzing things and understanding what's really happening and making sure everything's correct.
I think your best hope is for all the university professors who have access to this data. I mean, there's been dozens of publications about the Gulf, and there's a lot of information out there. You just need to be able to navigate it. So I'm sure that individuals and groups will be getting into this data, but you're right, it's not reporter accessible.
Hi, I'm Judith Sylvester from LSU, and I'm in mass communication, but I watch what our scientists do at LSU a lot, and I've interviewed several scientists throughout this process in the last few years, and a couple of things have really struck me. One is that I interviewed one scientist who said, journalists have no sense of how long this takes. They said they want to know tomorrow what we're finding out today, and he said, we have to peer review it, and we have to, you know, do replications and make sure it's there. And he said, it's really frustrating for us when journalists keep calling us and saying, what have you got, what have you got, what have you got, when we don't have anything yet. The other thing is that we have a regular, I don't know if they'll continue doing it, but for the last few years, there's been a Deepwater Horizon conference at LSU where the scientists present what they can about what they know. And I have a couple of concerns about that. One thing is BP is paying for an awfully lot of this, and BP puts a lot of restrictions on what they can actually put out.
And your question is?
And my question is, not so much a question as I'm just trying to expound on what she said. But the other thing is that that one of the scientists, you know, at LSU said basically that the Gulf is a huge petri dish and we're waiting to see what grows. And I think that that's where we are. So do you all have any different views of it than that?
You want to comment? Well, let's grab another question or an actual question.
Yeah.
Well, now that we've been told there'll be no answer to any questions for years and years. I'm sorry, Alex Nussbaum at Bloomberg News. The offshore industry is pushing to drill in ever deeper waters, ever farther away, expected to do more and more of that. I wonder if you think there is any reason to think the potential impacts from deeper drilling would be different, worse, better, about the same? What can we expect as the industry pushes farther out?
Thank you.
Lucinda? I don't know. I would defer that question to Jason. The safety of drilling and the environmental issues are beyond my abilities.
All right, just for those of you who showed up late, Jason Ryan, can you just hold your hand up, is a spokesman for BP, and he can help you get to the right people to answer that question. Or Mark could probably answer it as well.
Mark Schlesing, Times Picayune. Okay, so I'm going to try to make this into a question. After Hurricane Katrina, the Department of Defense put up something called the Interagency Performance Evaluation Task Force, which did a forensic evaluation. And independent organizations also put up task force that did forensic evaluations, the National Academy, the National Science Foundation, and then the state of Louisiana, the Louisiana team. And they came to conclusions. They had documents that came to conclusions. At the beginning of the spill, there was a task force that came to conclusions about how the spill occurred. But there has not been any sort of similar task force aimed at doing conclusions of the effects of the spill. Is there a place for such a task force? Is that something that needs to be built into the Oil Pollution Act? Is there any place in present law where it can occur?
I'll let the Fed start with this.
I'm not sure I can answer that question. It's probably a better question for somebody more informed about the broader NERDA. I mean, NERDA itself ultimately will come up with an injury report, and I don't know that that's getting at what you're looking for from the task force, but you know, maybe a task force would be a good idea.
So I agree that I think a task force would be a fantastic idea to help bridge the gap between what happens in NERDA and has legal restrictions and what stakeholders and the public are hoping to understand about what's happening or the effects of the spill, and to do it in a very comprehensive way. There's very few comprehensive studies out there. But I think at this time, you'd have to get through some of those legalities of a lot of the data is not available, even if the scientists were ready to release it, because they're just not able to release it based on the trustees. So I think you'd have some complications there, but I think it's worth exploring.
Is anything you want to comment?
Yeah.
You've been through two.
I just wanted to say really quickly, there's some really mega documents out there that have a lot about what we know about what's going about after during the spill and after, and those are the OSAT reports. So OSAT 1 was, you know, a lot of water column, and I think there was an ecological supplement in there. OSAT 2 looked at nearshore conditions, and OSAT 3 addressed some of the lingering oil that Natalie was talking about. And there's actually a lot more information than you realize. Somebody's got to wade through those documents and translate them. But those are, the OSAT stands for Operational Science Advisory Team, and those are government reports.
It's really a question?
So I'm Rebecca Shaw. I'm with Environmental Defense Fund, and I love both the science presentations, but I don't find them inconsistent with one another. One is a deep presentation on the physiological effects of the oil spill on dolphins, a long-lived mammal. The second one was sort of a general presentation about what you might expect about resilience in ecological systems. So I don't find them different, but what I'd really like to know from Lucinda is, where do you go from here? How do you start getting into better understanding, and what studies are going on to better understand the population impacts, the long-term impacts of the exposure, not just the what the potential impacts might be, particularly for those kinds of aspects of the ecosystem where you would expect to see impacts like long-lived mammals and such. And I just also want to say I would like to know a whole lot more about this, but truly, because the presence of the pollutant doesn't mean that the system is healthy. So what are studies are going on to make sure that that marsh is actually truly recovering, just not recovering from the present absence of oil?
Well, I could tell you about my role, which is to review the studies as they come out, the published studies, and sometimes to dig into the data that are available and do comparisons and think about what that infers to the environment. I think the population studies start from the exposure analysis, and I don't know exactly who's doing those studies, so I guess part of my answer is I don't know. But I think the framework that I mentioned is the best way to start on that. And I think you had another question that I might be missing. Well, you know, I think I found the NOAA website to be really wonderful for gathering information. I spent a lot of time on it. So you can go into the IRMA. IRMA is a map. It's an interactive map, and it shows the degree of oiling, and that's a great resource. And on the unexplained mortality events, that's a great resource. So there's a, you just have to know how to navigate this stuff. But you know, I think there will be debates as well. So, an imperfect answer, but we know from what we're seeing after November 2012 that we're seeing continued recovery.
So I would just add to the marsh health that there's studies that have come out that said some things when it comes to marsh are have not been affected. But then there's studies like I talked about with the dispersant study and the nitrogen cycling. I mean, that's a biochemical process within the marsh that can have long-term effects on that marsh. We know that there's accelerated vegetation loss. We know some species of vegetation are easily killed, their root systems killed by oiling, and others are more resilient to that oiling. And so we've seen some of these studies come out that give us the complexity of the marsh impact. But I do expect long-term impacts on the health of the marshes that were oiled.
Questions?
Hi, my name is Zoe. I'm from Newsweek. I had a question specifically about the dolphin studies. I know we've seen some transgenerational effects in shrimp, and I was wondering if there was any further study of that in more long-lived mammals and looking at the generation that was maybe that came after this generation directly affected by this bill.
Not in dolphins. I mean, there have been experimental studies looking at transgenerational effects. You're correct. That's something we've certainly thought about, but trying to set up a study to actually be able to monitor that in the wild would be very, very difficult to do. But, yeah, that is something that's been reported in the literature for experimental studies.
Have we exhausted everyone? Well, let me ask you, Lucinda, we've got dead dolphins, we've got diseased, lung disease dolphins, we've got aborted fetus. You had issues with that paper. You didn't really expand on that. Maybe you just briefly summarize what your concerns were about the paper.
Yeah, well, just to put it all in a nutshell, I had issues with study design and issues with framing the problem. And the study design part of the story is there were two bays, and I was really happy to see that third location, Lori. There's two bays. One we know has healthy dolphins. The other we know has sick dolphins from before the spill. So how are you going to tease out the causation issues associated with that knowledge? Typically what you'd want to do is look at a reference location with no impacts and a bay that was solely impacted by the oil, and we weren't able to do that. Another way that that could have been helped is to look at a lightly oiled location that had the UME added. And just to touch on the UME, so anyway, I think there were some study design issues and how the problem was framed. The part about the framing of the problem, the issues there were, there's some great advice by Glenn Suter, who's with the EPA, about framing causation issues. And two really important considerations are timing and symptoms. And I think what I would have liked to have seen was a more rigorous evaluation of the various symptoms of UMEs. For example, we know that Brucella has been identified in about a third of the dolphins, at least the last time I checked the NOAA website. So we know that there's a Brucella infection in these dolphins. We know that we have dolphins that have been affected by toxic algae in other environments. So I would have liked to see a side-by-side comparison of these different stressors that lead to the UME side-by-side with the condition of the dolphins in Barataria Bay.
Can I respond? Yes. Yeah, okay, thanks. Well, yeah, there's a couple of things there. First of all, the study that was published is the first results from the 2011 assessments. There's still a number of ongoing investigations, and those will be coming out soon. So that's one piece of the puzzle. It's not a complete study in itself. It's preliminary findings. That said, you know, you brought up other things, and Glenn Suter has come up with this or talks a lot about the weight of evidence and using criteria to establish a weight of evidence. I think what this study does do is to start to build that weight of evidence. We're seeing effects specifically from the published study, we're seeing effects that are consistent with what you might see in experimental studies of oil. So that's, you know, part of the building of the weight of evidence. We did look at other stressors. We looked at a number of persistent contaminants, which have been shown to be issues in marine mammals in the past because they're top-level predators. We looked specifically at things like DDT, which metabolite of DDT has been associated with the same type of issues with adrenals. Mitotane is actually used as a treatment for hyperadrenocorticism, so overactive adrenals. So that's something that we'd want to be concerned with because that actually has a potential link with the effects that we were seeing. We looked at that, and the levels of DDT in the blubber of dolphins in Barataria Bay were very low, not just in comparison to Sarasota, but in comparison to 16 other sites along the U.S. coast where we've looked at that same compound. We also looked at 45 polychlorinated biphenyls. We looked at 11 polybrominated compounds. We looked for levels of brevetoxin and domoic acid that didn't make it in the paper, but those are, you know, some of the toxic algae issues that you mentioned in other UMEs, and we didn't find any evidence of particularly high levels of, and in fact, I think all the brevetoxin was below detection, and there wasn't particularly high levels of domoic acid. So we did look at a number of other things, and we weren't just comparing that population with Sarasota Bay. We were comparing it with data that we had acquired over, you know, historically from other dolphin populations, and the health issues that we saw in Barataria Bay were much worse and different than what we've seen along all these other areas of the coast. So it's not just two sites, it's actually multiple sites. We started with those two sites in 2011 because those represented extremes. It was a very heavily oiled area and then an unoiled area, and then we've been expanding since then.
Questions? Can't believe you guys call yourselves journalists. Jeez.
So what can we do as journalists to explain the uncertainty that's out there to our readers? How can we explain the process that you guys are going through, which is still an incomplete process, in ways that still hold the public's interest and also forwards the story?
So I think as journalists, to me, what I would hope is that you do pester the scientists for the data and for the interpretation of the data, and pester the natural resource damage trustees to release more and more information as they have it. And then really rely on independent research where you can to understand the implications moving forward.
Yeah, I'm fine with being pestered. That works for me. But I think the other thing, too, is as things do come out, to try to put it into context of, you know, these are complicated systems. There's a lot of natural variation that goes on in marine ecosystems that's, you know, even in marine ecosystems that aren't affected by oil, there's a lot of natural variation, and so it's just very complex system. So I think it's, you know, you report results, report them in that context, that it's complicated and there's more to build the entire story.
I think the key phrase there was hold their interest. Probably teaching them science wouldn't do that. But I do think it's really important to ground some of this information in the larger picture and talk about what we do know and then focus in on some areas that are still unknown. And I think having a scientist that can help you translate or bridge that gap could help. So,
last chance. Okay. Question is, what? How do we know what scientists to trust?
Well, two of you here and giving two different views.
Okay, all right.
Clearly, you know, whichever organization you're with influences some of what you say.
So I think from the outside perspective, just, I guess, a basic journalism is to show both sides. Right, and if there's controversy about a scientific result, to try and understand if it's 1% and 99% of the scientists are on the other side, then you've got some sort of consistency. But if it really is a controversial issue that we don't have enough data to know to show the whole story.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, You're an environmental journalist, so you have some science background, I'm sure. So I'm sure you're good at interpreting, you know, different views. But yeah, talking to other people and seeing where other scientists fall in the same situation. So just dig as deep as you can.
Well, yeah, maybe the good approach would be to talk to two different people, get a couple of different perspectives, because scientists often do disagree, and often for good reasons.
All right, you want one last question?
Okay.
Pulls the hometown advantage.
So I'm going to ask you the same question, but in a different form. So when you see a new paper that comes out on this, and it's from scientists you don't know, how do you figure out for yourself, what steps do you take to figure out what that scientist's worth is.
All right, Lucinda?
Well, I think one of the wonderful things about science is that we operate from a common sense of principles and practices and rigor. And if we're focusing on a little tiny thing, we might have something to say at that scale, but stepping back is where, you know, some of the controversies or uncertainties may arise. So I think the fact that we operate from those common principles and strive to be objective and rigorous in our analyses helps.
So personally, when a new paper comes out, I mean, I'll go and look. If it's something I'm really interested in, look at their references, and then I will search for the subject and see who they didn't reference as well, because that usually tells you the opposite side.
And I think for me, when I'm reviewing an article, there is, you know, a set of what I'm trying to say. So just in general, the way that it's written, how well they describe their assumptions, are they telling you all their assumptions? Do you understand the methodology they used, and are they being explicit about all the steps they took? Because that can give you an indication that they're not being clear about how they came to their conclusions.
And for me, I always look at who was sourced, and I pick out any of those that I know, and I often look for those in warring camps, and you know, really do my own personal peer review. But anyway, I think we should thank our panelists very much. It's time to wrap up. I'm not sure we got to the untold tale of the ecological toll, but the next time that Mark brings SEJ back here, in a decade from now, hopefully we'll have the real story. So.